This week marks the year anniversary of the passage of the health law, the most ambitious social program since Medicare. The bill has been incredibly contentious, drawing fire from Democrats and Republicans alike. This morning, what the law looks like a year later, what's working, what's not, and what to expect down the road. Well, good morning. I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm keeping you company today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And as always, we welcome your questions and comments. What do you think of the healthcare law a year later? Are you still confused, as polls show most Americans are? Well, our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And Mary Agnes Carey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you give us a status report about how the law is functioning so far in this first year?
Sure. There are a lot of provisions that went into effect for plan years starting after last September 23rd, which was the six-month anniversary of the law. But for most of us, that meant as of January 1st of this year, because for most Americans, if you're getting health insurance at work, your new plan year starts January the 1st. So, for example, a lot of people have to keep their adult child up to age 26 on their health insurance policy. This has become a very popular provision. If you've got someone who's they've graduated from college and maybe they haven't found a job yet or their job doesn't have health insurance, they can stay on their parents' plan. A lot of small businesses have taken advantage of a small business tax credit that is part of the law to try to help small businesses purchase coverage. There's also some controversy there about how it works and how much is available, but at least for some businesses, they've been able to take advantage of that. Seniors have gotten some help in two different ways with their prescription drug costs. Last year, 4 million seniors received a one-time $250 check when they fell into something that's known as the donut hole. This is the gap in coverage in the Medicare prescription drug plan. And starting this year, once seniors hit that donut hole, they can get a 50% discount on their brand name drugs. And 48,000 seniors have used that so far. So that's been a fairly popular program, and federal officials expect that number to grow as the year continues. There's a provision in the law, 5,000 employers have applied to be part of a program to help with early retirees' health costs. And here we're talking about people 55 to 64. They haven't qualified for Medicare, but they're still covered by an employer's plan. The government will pay part of those costs as part of that program. There are provisions to look at how much your health insurance company is spending of your premium dollar on health care. Insurers have to spend at least 80% of that dollar on your health care. Lifetime limits have been phased out, or rather eliminated, for health insurance plans. Annual limits starting to be phased out starting this year, fully phased out in 2014. In the individual market, where there was a problem known as rescissions, where people would sign up for coverage and then it got canceled in some cases once they got sick, unless you committed a fraud on that application, they're not allowed to cancel your insurance. And another major provision of the law that's gone into effect is on for about 85, 88 million Americans who have health insurance for your preventive care. You wouldn't get any co-payments, deductibles, or cost-sharing for things like a mammogram or a colonoscopy. So there's a whole array of provisions that have gone into effect.
Now, there's so much to it. You can see, in essence, why, as polls have shown, people are confused about it. I mean, people have popularized some aspects of it, as you said, the 26-year-old coverage on the parent plan, for instance. But there are parts of this that are still kind of under the radar. And I gather that one of these is the long-term care requirement, or not requirement, but provision.
The long-term, yeah, this is interesting. In the department of things perhaps that aren't working so well, there's something known as the CLASS Act. It's a provision where people would be automatically placed into a program. You could opt out of it. You would pay a small premium, and then if you needed help later on staying in your home, you needed help with meals or other sorts of assistance, you would get a cash benefit. Right now they're thinking it would average about $50 a person. But as the law has progressed and this particular provision's come under fire, as of many elements of the entire law by Republicans, the head of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, has come out and publicly said right now the CLASS Act, this long-term care support provision, isn't really going to work as it's currently structured and they want to rework it, they may change how much the premium is paid, they may change the amount of money you receive, but it's one of those longer-range programs, hasn't gone into effect yet. They've come out and said they've got to rework it, and that's something we're watching to see what changes they make.
In that this is sort of a fragile act going forward, as it was, all the contention surrounding it, when you talk about things like the Class Act not being able to work as they're written, how big a deal is that?
Well, it is, of course, it's significant that any time you have to rework a provision of a law that's passed, that is a significant element and it's important. But in some ways, it's not surprising. I mean, look at the undertaking of the health law. It is sweeping. It is comprehensive. Some elements went into effect upon enactment when the president signed the bill a year ago. Some, as we just discussed, went into effect for plan years starting after last September 23rd. Some provisions don't go into effect until 2014. Here you're talking about the health insurance exchanges and the subsidies to help people buy coverage and the Medicaid expansion. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me, as someone who's covered health care for a long time, that there's a lot of political wherewithal to pass a measure as big as a health reform law, that implementers would go back, especially as different provisions come under fire, and say, as we implement that, we've got to make some changes. There's always a difference of when something passes, and then as it's implemented, changes can be made along the way. There's a rulemaking process. People can comment. There's certainly a whole political atmosphere. So in some ways, I think it's completely predictable they'd go back and revisit something like the Class Act.
Is the Obama administration, a year later, considering this a victory?
Oh, absolutely. And President Obama has been steadfast in his support, his defense. And they've shown, some people say it's, let's look at something, the waivers that they've given to some plans. There are some limited benefit plans that needed a waiver from the change in the annual limits, for example. And HHS has granted something like 2,000 of those waivers. Critics have said, if you are exempting so many health insurance plans from the requirements, that shows how weak the law is. President Obama and Democrats who favor the law would say, no, it shows that we have flexibility. The administration has tried to be flexible. They don't want people to lose coverage as they implement the law, but they have really held the line on things like defunding of the law. Republicans in the House of Representatives have voted overwhelmingly to repeal the law, to defund the law, and the president and Democrats have pushed back against that. This is a signature policy achievement for President Obama, and I think he will defend it in any way he needs to protect it, in his view.
How about the challenges in the courts? How are those progressing?
Well, it's kind of interesting that here we're talking about challenges on this requirement that an individual has to purchase health insurance by 2014. There are some exemptions, but that most people would have to purchase it or pay a fine. This has been challenged by many states on constitutional grounds. The administration has had about a dozen of those suits dismissed. When they've gone to adjudication, they've won two of them in the courts. They've lost two. Everyone expects this to be settled by the Supreme Court, possibly next summer, which would be right in the heat of the 2012 presidential election. But it's significant because, to your point earlier about people being confused, I think it adds to the confusion factor. If you're in a state where your attorney general has said, I am suing, or your governor has said, I'm suing to stop the individual mandate, you might think that the law isn't going forward when, in fact, until these cases are settled, and depending on what the ruling would be, the implementation of the health law is absolutely going forward. And so I think it is confusing for people to hear about, oh, gosh, the House of Representatives voted to defund the law. And there's a court challenge that is going to go before the Supreme Court on the individual mandate. It just sort of adds to the confusion out there about what does the law do and what it does not do.
Well, we should talk about the prevailing emotion surrounding this health care law, and it is confusion. A year later, it's still confusion, a CNN poll has found. Tell us about why that is and what's going on.
Well, I think that it's part of it is the fact that the law isn't implemented all at one time. So it's a little difficult. For example, we talked at the top of this discussion about adult children up to 26 getting on a parent's plan or help with seniors in the donut hole, right? So maybe your listeners have heard about the health insurance exchanges and the subsidies. And so they want to get one. They want to get a subsidy, and they think, I'm uninsured. I can buy coverage through that health insurance exchange. Well, that doesn't happen until 2014. Let's talk about another provision that's actually happening right now. It's called the high-risk pools to try to help people who are currently uninsured get coverage, building to 2014 when the broader elements of the law are implemented. Even in the high-risk pool, unless you've been without health insurance for 6 months and you were denied health insurance because of your medical status, you can't get into one of those high-risk pools. And then even if you qualify, they might be too expensive. So again, we're talking about the sweep and the complexity of the law itself is hard to understand. And then when you have a very active debate on Capitol Hill with Republicans in both chambers fighting against implementation, fighting against funding the law, I think for the average person, we're all juggling our work lives and our home lives, and we have a lot going on. It's just kind of hard to figure out what it all means. You might hear a little bit here or there, but I spend a lot of my time following the health law, and even I get confused about certain things. So I think it's very understandable that people out there are just confused about it.
But is it a failing on anybody's part? Has somebody not been doing their job in creating the talking points?
Well, there is a concern that Democrats have not, and the president has not, sold this law to the public. And that has been a target, that they haven't been out there defending it, and they haven't been pushing the elements of it strongly against the Republican attacks. But to that point, I mean, let's look at all the things that are happening with the first-year anniversary of the law. Groups that support the law have had 200 events around the country. I can tell you that the Obama administration has had their people out everywhere talking about it. The federal government has a website they've had up since the law was signed. I think it's healthcare.gov, which very interactive, and it's very consumer-friendly. You can get in there and find what you need. And I think that the administration has tried to sell, or proponents tried to sell, the elements of the law to the public, but as interesting as they may be to individuals, and as much as they help, you know, kids up to 26 stay on a policy, or seniors, or someone who may have a catastrophic illness, they no longer have a lifetime limit, what's gone into effect now may only impact a smaller amount of people. And that's part of the administration's problem. The bigger provisions that are going to ensure, by estimates, 32 million people will get coverage because of the subsidies and the exchanges, because of the Medicaid expansion, that doesn't happen until 2014. So for a lot of people, unless you have a child up to 26 who's on your policy, or you're a senior and you hit that Medicare prescription donut hole, or you're in the individual market and you've had a policy canceled under the rescission practice, you may not necessarily see any of this impacting you right now. And I think that's why the proponents' campaign to sell the bill perhaps has not been as successful as they wanted. And again, explaining this is complicated. On the other side, to the opponents of the bill, for Republicans in the House of Representatives that are up on the floor of the House every day going after provisions, talking about things that they know people dislike, for example, the individual mandate, that in some ways is a much easier message to sell than to explain to people, this provision goes into effect now, this provision goes into effect 2014, to try to articulate all the provisions and their complexity. It's a very hard thing to do.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that. A lot of people haven't been affected with the benefits yet, or the coverage yet, when I gather one of the critiques of Republicans has been that this bill is, or this law is, front-loaded with the goodies up top, things like the coverage for 26-year-olds up to 26 staying on their parents' plan, the $250 check that seniors got who entered that donut hole period. So you don't think then that it has been front-loaded?
Well, it's. I think when Republicans talk about front-loaded, I think they're talking more about a lot of the fees that are levied, the new taxes, the reductions in the Medicare Advantage plans. These are these private plans in the Medicare program that provide coverage to seniors. They're going to start to see the Medicare Advantage plans start to see their reimbursements from the federal government cut next year. There are taxes on medical devices, taxes on insurers, changes in how hospitals are reimbursed. As of, I think, last year, they started taxing indoor tanning services. That, I think, is what the Republicans are referring to, in the sense of you're front-loading it. You're collecting all these taxes now, but your big benefits come later.
Do you have any sense of how other social programs like this have been perceived by the public? Is it typical, the confusion that we're seeing, and also the animosity, the strife around it? I'm thinking of, well, you know, Medicare or the New Deal going back farther. Is it typical what we're seeing, the response this time?
I think it is. It gets to the argument which America has always had and will always have over the role of government. What is the role of government in various aspects of our lives? And this is a complete overhaul in many ways, a comprehensive overhaul of the health insurance system. If you're going to have the government administering subsidies, expanding the Medicaid program, and states can run these health insurance exchanges, but if they don't or they opt out, the federal government will do it for them. I think if you go back to when Medicare was created in 1965, that wasn't the easiest political lift to do, and there was controversy, and there was fear and concern about what it would mean for the federal treasury and did we really need it. But the political will was that this was the direction in which those elected interpreted the public wanted to go. And Medicare certainly has had its ups and downs, but it's still with us. It's insuring something like 46 million elderly and disabled Americans. And I think that a key complaint from some business groups and many Republicans is that this law has too much government involvement, and that's the wrong way to go. But the counterweight is that much of the law is built on the current health insurance system. The proponents of the law went out of their way to try not to displace people with employer-based health insurance, which is something like 180 million Americans. And they were also trying to respond to concerns from people, especially in the individual market. I can't get covered because I have this pre-existing condition. I can't afford this insurance. I can't get coverage for my family. I had a catastrophic illness. Someone in my family had cancer. We blew through our lifetime cap, and I now have to file for medical bankruptcy. President Obama and Democrats were trying to balance a lot of interests. And you cited, I believe, a Gallup poll, which has about a 59% view of people unfavorable to the law. Several polls have kind of split around the 50% mark. I think that the public is still trying to figure it out, and we may not really know the public view on this until full up. I mean, we know where it is now, of course, but as implementation continues, what will the approval-disapproval rate be in 2014 once it's fully phased in? That, to me, is kind of really the way to judge this law. But, of course, a political opponent would like to kill it way before 2014. You know, once you have the subsidies go out, the exchanges start, the Medicaid expansion starts, it's much harder to bring that back than it would be now.
So the jury is still out. Well, we are talking this hour with Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, talking about the Health Care Reform Act a year later and wondering what you think of this law a year later. Are you still confused, as polls show most Americans are? Obviously, there is a lot yet still to be implemented, but with what you've seen so far, has your opinion changed or stayed the same? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm filling in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 10 o'clock, I hope you'll stay with us. We'll be talking about how the 21st century mother-daughter bond compares to previous generations, and looking at modern mother-daughter relationships as well. Well, this hour we're talking about the passage of the health care law a year later, taking a look at public attitudes, what's changed and what hasn't, and in terms of implementation, what is already working and what needs tweaking. And we'll go to our phone lines now. We have with us Judy, our first caller from Ripon. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've called every single time there's an issue about this health care bill or health care coverage just in general. I'm a nurse, and I think that we could do a lot of good. You've got a ready database of all the registered nurses who are registered in every state to do a mailing. I don't know how much that would cost, but do a mailing of the common talking points, because we see people and people's families. We spend more time with them. This is not a slam on any physician or anything, but we spend more time talking with these people than most doctors do. We are seeing people at their worst. We are seeing people when they are voicing their concerns about their health care plans and their health care. I have done a lot of talking with people to try to explain why this is a very good thing, that we need this. And I've also had patients who are laying in a hospital bed, sicker than sick, saying to me as they're watching Fox News, you know, and knowing that this patient is receiving Medicaid, saying that this health care bill is a bad thing. And when they're surrounded by family and they're all standing and they're agreeing, it's really hard to say, well, wait a minute, you know, why do you think this is a bad thing? The government is paying for your health care. You are obviously, you know, in desperate need. And this is, we're trying to target people who are in desperate need and do good things for, you know, people who are disadvantaged, marginalized in society, in addition to, you know, a million other wonderful things that this health care bill does. You know, people are horribly uninformed, and I think that the boots on the ground, if you're going to tweak this bill, if there's anything going to be happening to spread the word about why it's good, you need to target registered nurses. We are probably the best way that you can spread this information, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you, Judy. And Judy, obviously coming from a nurse's perspective there, and I don't know, how would that fly, having sort of activist nurses for the healthcare law?
Well, I think she has an interesting point, and I think, for example, if she thinks the health law is good for a particular reason, and she's in, I find that fascinating, if I heard her correctly, she's in a room with a patient who's on Medicaid, who's saying a Medicaid expansion in the health law is a bad idea. That's kind of ironic, but really interesting. I think that there's nothing wrong. Medical professionals all over this country have different views of this law. And if she finds it favorable and thinks it's a good thing, and I want to say that the American Nurses Association endorsed the health law, I'm pretty sure they did, then she should be working with her local people and her local groups. And you could come up with the top 10 things in the health law that are in effect now that benefit your patients the most, and you could talk to them about it. I mean, I don't know what the rules are in our hospital, whether or not our hospital administration agrees or disagrees, but medical professionals have their own views, and they've been very clear about them. And as she notes, many of us spend a lot more time with our nurses than we do our physicians. So if she sees things that are part of the law in the books that people need to understand, I think she's within her rights to talk about them and point people to different websites or things that she thinks are beneficial. Because, you know, as the political makeup currently stands, Republicans can't repeal the law right now. They run the House of Representatives. They don't run the Senate. President Obama would veto anything if it ever got to him, and there aren't strong enough numbers in either chamber to override a veto. But if they, you know, my point is that if they overturned the law, then all this stuff would go away. But it is now the law of the land. And if she finds provisions of it that are beneficial, she should talk to her patients about it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Judy. And we move to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I guess this is more of a comment, but it's something that never seems to, you know, people talk about it, but they don't really give you enough information to know, and that is that, you know, if insurance companies have to change the way they do business, which is going to cost them more money to insure people, then that means that they're going to increase the premiums to cover that cost. And I think where people get confused or just don't know is, how much is it going to cost me as an average middle-class working person when I get my coverage from wherever I get it? You know, over the last few years, insurance premiums have gone up, and I think that's the fear that people have, is when this fully goes into effect, that you're going to see a big jump in insurance premiums.
What do you think, Mary Agnes?
I think, Ralph, that's a concern a lot of people have, and it's not clear exactly what will happen. As he notes, insurance premiums have been going up for the last few years. Part of the reason insurance premiums have increased is we all pay for uncompensated care.
If someone goes to the hospital and they need medical care, a federal law called EMTALA requires that hospital to take care of folks and to stabilize them. Hospitals, physicians, and other healthcare providers would tell you that Medicare and Medicaid and even private insurance doesn't necessarily always pay them the cost of care. And so there's cost shifting within the system. Proponents of the law say, let's get that uninsured rate down. The health law would cover something like 94 to 95% Americans, according to estimates. And this is at fully phased in, I want to say, by like 2010. By 2020, that's what would happen in that ballpark, right? So if you get everyone covered, will it reduce costs? No one knows. His point is, if it costs the health insurance companies more money, they're going to charge more for premiums, right? There are things that they're going to have to cover, and so they will raise their rates accordingly. There's a tax on high-cost health insurance plans. There's other taxes on the insurance industry. While the tax is theoretically on the plan, I think it will come straight through to the premium. Now, here's where the pushback on cost is in the law. States will be able to, if a health insurer wants to increase a premium more than 10%, states can require them to explain why they want to do that. If they thought a insurer was acting inappropriately in coverage decision or cost, that sort of thing, they can exclude them from that state-based exchange where there will be millions of people all over the country getting coverage. So that is the pushback they hope that will reduce health insurance rates. But one criticism of this law from the health insurance industry and from many others involved on both sides of the coin, the debate rather, is that it doesn't do enough to control health care costs. And that the fear is that the bill will not control health care costs, and they'll continue to climb to put health insurance out of reach of people. And so that is going to be a continued focus and implementation of this law and throughout the country. And I think that Ralph raises an extremely valid point. People are worried about this. All of us look at something as big as the health insurance law, and you want to know what's in it for me, what's in it for my family. And people are worried about health care costs, and that's something that everyone will be watching.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your call, Ralph. And another call, Diane is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hello. What percentage of the people who are against the health care plan want single payer? And as far as Part D is concerned, the insurance companies are making a killing. They double and triple the amount of the prescriptions in the last year.
You talk about the price of prescriptions in Medicare Part D for drugs, right?
Correct.
Okay. This is very interesting on your comment about Part D. Part of the law, we talked about this a little bit earlier, once you fall in the donut hole, you get a 50% discount on your brand name drugs. Critics have said, now, wait a minute, the drug industry is just going to jack up those prices, right, to her point. They're just going to raise them. And so the discount, you'll be getting a discount, but you'll be paying more for those drugs because they'll raise prices to make up for that discount. Now, the counterweight, of course, the drug industry says they're not doing that, but the reality is that the insurers that offer this prescription drug benefit are negotiating with the drug makers because they want to lower their costs and they want to try to get a lower premium to get someone, I don't know if she's a Medicare beneficiary, but to get Medicare beneficiaries enrolled. So that is the thought. That's a cost, a counterweight, if you will, to try to keep drug prices down in the prescription drug program. But I don't know exactly how effective that will be, and I'm watching this whole 50% discount in the donut hole issue for her very point about pricing. Now, to her point about single payer, I know that there are a lot of people that wanted single payer or a public option. It didn't prevail this time, and the political will was not there. And again, to our earlier discussion about how the thought was you don't want to undermine the private insurance market and employer-based systems, there was concern that a public option might do that. But let's remember that, as we talked about, how when law is implemented, it can be changed. And I don't think because a public option didn't survive the most recent health debate doesn't mean it couldn't come back again, because people will be watching, to the earlier caller's point, prices. What's the competition? Can people afford health insurance? What do these exchanges look like all over the country? What are the options for coverage? And if the political will changed, a public option
could be added. It doesn't mean it's never going to happen, but it didn't survive the last debate.
Well, obviously, this was an incredible move at all to have gotten this far, considering the outrage and on both sides around it. Does this in any sense, has it opened the floodgates at all in that it would make it easier for this to happen down the road?
Well, I think you have to kind of take it one step at a time. One defining moment of the health reform debate for me was when Scott Brown was elected to the Senate in Massachusetts. And let's remember that he won Ted Kennedy's seat when Senator Kennedy passed away. That had been held by Senator Kennedy for a long time. It was a major shift that this Republican won, right? And so the thought on the Hill was maybe health reform is dead. Maybe it's not going to happen. And I can't say it was a phoenix rising from the ashes. I don't want to completely, you know, bury it or overstate it. But it was a big setback for the president and for Democrats. And they had to kind of gather themselves and figure out where to go. And it was still was an incredibly hard victory for them to get. So I think that I don't know if it necessarily makes it easier to make more changes to the healthcare system, but the fact that you have a law that's in place, to our earlier discussion about selling it to the public, right? Democrats and the president really have a big job on their hands to sell this thing to the public, because let's remember, we have a split electorate. What happens in 2012? What if Republicans get the Senate? What if they got the White House? If they have the White House and the Senate and the House, then the health law would be repealed. I'm sure they'd have the votes to do that. So a lot of this depends on what happens politically on the Hill. But now Democrats have the majority in the Senate, they have the White House, and they have the power to go forth and administer it. And so the ground game is on. They've really got to make their case. If you've got a Gallup poll at 59% opposed, other polls have a 50-50 split, you've got half of the American public out there, you have to sell the law to them. And the interesting thing about this polling, it's fascinating reading, because people will say, well, I oppose the law. And someone will say, well, do you like the idea of keeping an adult child up to 26 on your health insurance policy? Well, yeah, I like that, because I have a son. My son just got out of college, and he doesn't have health insurance. Or do you like the idea of helping seniors with their prescription drug costs when they fall into the donut hole? Yes, I do like that. People like individual provisions, but they'll say they hate the law. Or they'll say they don't like the individual mandate because they think it's forcing them to buy insurance. But then you explain, well, 2014, if you have health insurance from your employer, you've met the individual mandate. You don't have to buy anything new. Then their opposition softens. So it's really, you have to look a little bit beyond the top lines here to figure out where people are.
So I think we have time for one more call before break. We have Janie joining us from Two Rivers. Hi, Janie.
Hi. I was just calling because my daughter had cancer at 14, so this is real personal to me. I am an advocate of this. I think it's fantastic. She's now in college, and she has access to our medical benefits, our insurance, and she'll have that until the age of 27. So I think this is super. I don't know what she would do without this, because one of her medications alone now costs $725 a month.
Hmm.
And that's just one medication. She takes three, which is, I think, $1,200 that our insurance company pays. And I don't think that her going through college, I don't think she'd be able to get on any type of system unless it was maybe a state system. They would hold it against her because she has cancer. They would hold it against her because of the cost of her high medications that she's on. And I am a strong advocate for this. Anyone that has children with any type of pre-existing conditions needs to look at this and say, yes, I think it's wonderful. And that was my comment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. And Mary Agnes, so we haven't talked about the banning of the pre-existing condition for children, too. I don't know how that applies to Janie, but what would you say to that?
Well, first of all, her story, for example, this is the type of story that proponents of the law want to get out there. Maybe your child, and you know, isn't in this position, but Janie, is that her name, the caller? Did I hear that correct?
Yes.
her daughter, right? Now, this didn't, you know, her daughter, she's right. Her daughter would have a really hard time getting health insurance if she had cancer, being a survivor of cancer, which is terrific, by the way, that she has survived that and that she is in college. That's great. And the cost per month of her health, of her prescriptions alone would be really tough for anyone to bear. And so this is the kind of provision that proponents of the law want to bring to light, and they want people to understand, look, this didn't happen to you, but if it had, the law would help you. And the law immediately banned insurers to discriminate against children for a pre-existing medical condition. But again, there were some complications with that. Some insurers that were in the child-only market had to take all comers, and they were worried about people getting in, buying policies, and then getting out or waiting till the kids were really sick or the other insurance didn't work or so on to get into the market. And so the other thing about this particular provision, they'll cover your child, but there's no limit on the cost. So for some families, the coverage may still be unaffordable, even though the health law says that you can't discriminate against a child with a pre-existing medical condition, that policy still might be unaffordable for people. And again, this is one of those provisions that lifting pre-existing conditions for everyone, not being able to deny insurance coverage based on pre-existing condition, that doesn't happen for everyone until 2014, because you really couldn't do that until your individual mandate requirement went into effect, and that's in 2014. So that ban on pre-existing doesn't kick in for everybody until 2014.
We're talking this hour with Mary Agnes Carey, a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, and we're looking at the health care law a year past its anniversary. It's its first anniversary, and we're wondering what you think a year later. Are you still confused? Do you have an opinion of the law, or are you waiting to see how things shake down a little bit? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you prefer, you can shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're looking at the health care law in its first year with Mary Agnes Carey, a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And I want to read a couple of emails here, Mary Agnes. This one is from Steve, who wants some recommendations for useful websites for non-professional listeners to learn more and to follow. Why don't we start with that one?
Got to plug Kaiser Health News here. We have a fantastic website, and it's free. It's spelled Kaiser, K-A-I-S-E-R, Health News, all one word, .org. And we have a lot of original reporting on the health law. We have a glossary of terms that you could read if you don't understand something. We've had all sorts of articles, summaries of the health law, so I've got to pitch that, number one. The Kaiser Family Foundation, we're an editorially independent program of that, but they have a great site as well, kff.org, that you can go to. It's called, and they have a special health reform source area of that website that can give you all sorts of information about the health care law. The administration, I think, has a very consumer-friendly website, healthcare.gov, that is very friendly. Now, of course, the critics of the law are going to argue about some of the things that are on that website. But I think if somebody trying to figure out what does the annual limit mean, what's the lifetime limit, what's this, what's that, you can type it in, you can get an answer. If you thought the answer they gave you was dumb or wasn't helpful, they have a little comment form. You could submit that. And I think that, let's see what else. Those are probably the three I would start with, I think, that are extremely helpful websites.
Okay, terrific. And another one. This is an email from Dave in Menominee, Michigan, who says, people are confused because there's one side trying to really confuse people. And when there's confusion, there's fear. Please remind us of the origins of donut hole. And whenever you mention the donut hole, bring up its origins briefly. Do you want to give a little backstory on donut hole?
On the donut hole. Gosh, let me see how he would explain the origins of the donut hole. Well, here's my understanding of why the donut hole is there. You have to go back to 2003 when there was a debate on Capitol Hill about whether or not to create the Medicare prescription drug program. Republicans were in charge. President Bush was in office. Republicans wanted to make this their signature issue on health care because many people often identify health care policy with Democrats. So
with any legislation, there's a certain amount of money that you decide you're going to spend, and you have to just decide how to spend it. And the debate over whether or not the debate over Medicare prescription drug coverage, whether was to do you design a program that simply helps the low income who can't afford prescription drug coverage, and people with catastrophic drug needs, right? That they're spending all this money out of their pocket, and it's incredibly unaffordable, or someone that can't afford it at all. Do you target your spending there, or do you decide to do a Medicare prescription drug benefit for all beneficiaries? And they decided for the latter. They decided to provide Medicare prescription drug coverage for all beneficiaries, which meant you had to fund it with the amount of money you had, which was, I think the cost of that law was about $400 billion over a decade, was the estimate. And so if you're going to spread the same amount of money over more people, they had to have that donut hole, that gap in coverage, where seniors were on their own. It's basically a period of time where you pay your basic deductible, which is about $325, I believe, and then you pay about 25% of your costs, and your plan pays about 75%. And so once you hit a certain amount, I want to say now it's around $3,700, that's the gap you're covering, the donut hole gap. You're paying through from that $325 deductible, then you pay your 25% until you get about $3,700. That's that gap in coverage. But that's my memory of why it occurred. Mm. They tried to help. It was a political decision. Let's help all seniors, not just some. And then his first point about people trying to confuse people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a debate, of course, because everything in Washington is a debate. But proponents of the law have really gone after Republicans and said, you're trying to scare people about the law. You're misrepresenting facts about the law. For example, there is no – it's a fact that they're cutting Medicare spending. They cut the rate of growth of Medicare as part of the health law. And so Republicans have said, hey, Democrats, President Obama, you cut $500 billion out of Medicare, and they ran on that in the fall election. And it is correct that they're cutting hundreds of billions of dollars out of Medicare, but there's more to it, like there always is, right? There's new spending on Medicare. There's the help with the 50%, the discount of the donut hole we're just talking about. There's a new wellness visit that 150,000 seniors have taken advantage of at the Medicare program. Seniors in Medicare will be able to get a lot of preventive services with no cost sharing, no deductible. A big cut in Medicare spending is on those Medicare Advantage plans we talked about. They're private insurers in Medicare. 25% of beneficiaries are in those programs. But the federal government spends on average something like 10-12% more on beneficiaries in Medicare Advantage than in fee-for-service. And so they want to equalize, and fee-for-service is your traditional Medicare program that 75% of the beneficiaries are on. And so what the federal government wants to do is even out those reimbursements to the private plans and the fee-for-service plans. And other spending reductions in Medicare are things that those industries agreed to, like the hospitals came to the table and said, if you will take some Medicare spending reductions, a lot of it is uncompensated care. Medicare help pays for that. And if you're going to insure more people, then we'll have less uncompensated care. So, again, you can debate the policy. Should you have done something? Why did you do it? But Democrats and proponents of the law and President Obama have said to Republicans, you're out there trying to scare people, and you're spreading facts about the law that are not untrue, and that is not fair. And I think that's what your caller was talking – listener was talking about.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we'll go back to our phones now. Janice joins us from La Crosse. Welcome,
yes.
Janice.
Hi. Yes, thank you. Good morning, ladies.
Morning.
Thank you so much. This is what I find objectionable, and that is I do not want the government telling me to pay for abortions, and I'm not going to take any money that I pay, blood money for that. I'm not going to do it. And I'm very upset about it. I don't want the money going to Planned Parenthood for abortions. I don't. And I just, this is so unconscionable for me. I'm Catholic. I can't handle it. I mean, I'm really upset. I just don't, it's like, I'm not going to pay for this that I am absolutely, totally opposed to. I'm not in Russia or a communist country. I mean, in the old days, it's like, telling me I'm going to pay for this killing. No.
Well, thank you, Janice.
Let me ask you, I don't know if she's still on the line,
yeah.
Ask your question. Planned Parenthood says they take the federal funding
And they can show you this in their accounting, and they do not use it at all for any abortions that they provide. They use it for other services.
Yeah, and that I've heard so much controversy about, you know, what exactly, what's the transparency for Planned Parenthood? What goes toward abortions? And they said, I mean, you've heard they fudge the numbers. I mean, you know, I was just down in Florida where they just started abortions down there because they said they needed the money. And so it's like, come on, you know what I mean? These guys, they need to come down on them and start having some true transparency, you know, and start changing the laws for, like, sonograms and things like this. Make them do some things that they've never had to do. No, they get millions of dollars, millions. It just gets poured into Planned Parenthood. They don't have to be accountable for abortions that much. They hardly, very minuscule for, what do you call it, adoptions, mostly abortions. That money's going for it, and I'm not going to be paying for it.
Well, there, you know, this is the debate, and this is more of a debate over the appropriations process right now. This is the debate over something called the continuing resolution. In Washington, we call it the CR for short. And this was an amendment that was adopted in the House of Representatives, on the floor of the House of Representatives, saying no federal funding for Planned Parenthood. Now, it's my understanding that Planned Parenthood has been more transparent about their accounting and that they have explained to the federal government, and they've shown people that they get federal money. For we spend it, you know, it's our federal money, but they get federal funding and they use it for services other than abortion. Now, the caller believes that's not accurate, and that's a continuous point of focus. But this is a debate on Capitol Hill about funding for Planned Parenthood. It shifts now to the Senate. Now, in the Senate, you've got three Republican senators, Murkowski of Alaska, Brown of Massachusetts, and Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, who've come out against the ban on the federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And the argument against the ban is that, number one, the belief is that they do segment the money and that they have shown that they do that, and that also Planned Parenthood provides a lot of medical care for poor women. And they also provide birth control. They provide pap smears, a variety of things to help people. The caller's point, and there are people arguing about exactly what does Planned Parenthood do with their money. Are they transparent enough? People that want the funding to stay feel they've been fully transparent. Obviously, your caller and others say they have not, but this is a flashpoint over the continuing resolution over federal funding that I think you'll hear a lot about.
All right. Well, Janice, I appreciate your phone call. And on to Michelle, joining us from Baraboo. Welcome, Michelle.
Good morning. I would like to share my opinion, which hasn't changed since the reform bill was passed. I've been in favor of it, as has my husband, and we still support it. But we have felt all along that the bill did not go far enough. We feel that what we were desperately needing was some significant regulation on the health insurance industry. The health insurance companies really only serve a role to make profit. They're an intermediary between the healthcare provider and the patient. They don't actually provide a service or any sort of benefit to the patient in terms of healthcare. And they are motivated to make profit, and we don't feel there's enough regulation in place that's going to allow, at least from their end of the perspective, for people like us to be able to afford health insurance. And whether this applies to the donut hole or someone like my husband and I who are self-employed, we feel the issue still comes down to profit. My husband's coming off of COBRA from his prior employer's employer-provided health insurance, so he's now buying on the individual market. And we were able to talk to underwriting before applying because we didn't want to risk a denial, because once you've been denied insurance coverage, you can't buy insurance coverage other than the high-risk pool. And our agent who spoke to the underwriter found out that on the individual market, there's a base rate, and they will rate you 25% more than that or 50% more than that based on your medical history. And they looked at my husband's history and said, we can't rate him high enough to cover our perceived risk, so we would deny him. But if he were to join the Chamber of Commerce in our community and pay that membership fee, this particular insurance company has a sort of group plan for members of the Chamber of Commerce. You go in individually through your own underwriting. So you're a member of the Chamber of Commerce. You have individual underwriting going in, and from there forward, you're part of a group, and your annual premium increases are based on the group's performance. And the underwriter said, we'll be able to rate him 300% over base price through the Chamber of Commerce plan, and then we would be willing to cover him, which would make our insurance premiums for his policy $1,000 a month.
Michelle, I'm gonna stop you there so we have time to respond. And Mary Agnes, we have about 30 seconds for your response.
The individual market is very tough. This caller's problem is faced by millions of people. They're going to make some changes where they hope in 2014 that you could buy health insurance through an exchange. I think you said he's self-employed. But that's the hope that but 2014, I know, is 3 years away. It's just tough.
Well, Mary Agnes Carey, I really appreciate your time this morning. It's been wonderful to talk with you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Mary Agnes Carey with us this morning as we look back at the Health Care Reform Act a year later. She is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Kathleen Dunn, of course, will be back with you next Monday. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for on-air production this morning. If you would like a copy of any of the programs you've heard this week, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. And today's program is 324D. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.